This is Johnny, the chubby, Caucasian, Christian, closeted conservative. Some might say I'm everything wrong with the world, but don't take their word for it. Make up your own mind. Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Chubby Caucasian Christian Closeted Conservative. Today, I'd like to chew the fat a little bit about gender dysphoria and how the world has just taken the beautiful gift that God gave us of intimacy between a man and woman and just broken it, smashed it, spit on it, bent it, and then gave it back to God and said, look, now it's better. One thing that I'd like to challenge my Christian brothers and sisters with them, the church as a whole, is that it's time to stop accepting what the world says about gender, sex, sexualism. It's time to take that gift back. And the way we do that is to try to teach the next generation this amazing gift that God gave us instead of allowing gender dysphoria and gender identification disorders be normalized in our society. And I'm going to talk about this more a little bit later, but I think the Florida Parental Rights and Education Bill is a good step. We can talk about that a little bit later. What I believe people of the world right now are just trying to normalize some of these topics. And again, as Christians, we need to not be afraid to talk about this. We've kept silent on this issue, and the world has just steamrolled it, taken it, like I said before, broken it, and handed it back to us saying, look, we fixed it, now it's better. And I will place a lot of the blame on that on the Christian church. It's a topic, we don't talk about this, that's inappropriate. We're in fact, we should be controlling the narrative when it comes to that. And if you don't believe that they're trying to normalize things, I recently came across an article. It's from Mel Magazine, and the article is titled Bebop and Rocksteady Are the Most Beautiful Love Story Ever Told. And for individuals who don't know who that is, they are villains in the cartoon Ninja Turtles. My son and I, we were watching one of the older Ninja Turtle cartoons from like early 80s or late 90s. And Bebop and Rocksteady are on there. They're two bad guys. And I always get them confused which one is who and why they were made and everything. So my son was asking me some questions and I pulled out my device and was doing some research and telling him this one, is Bebop and this one's Rocksteady. And I came across an article, Bebop and Rocksteady Are the Most Beautiful Love Story Ever Told. Now, I don't do any research for this show on my device. So the fact that I would get an article like this attempting to give this impression and help the reader, who might be a younger audience, to give them the idea that Bebop and Rocksteady are more than just Shredder sidekicks. So basically what is up with these characters is after Shredder loses to the Ninja Turtles a couple times, he decides to try to get his own mutants and he goes to the zoo, he steals a warthog and a rhino and he uses some machine and these two guys from a gang to mutate them into Bebop and Rocksteady. This article, I'm going to quote a lot from this article, but as for their mutant henchmen, Bebop and Rocksteady, all they had was each other and the beautiful relationship and possibly more that they shared. One thing about Bebop and Rocksteady too is their comic relief in the show. They're always tripping over each other, bumping into each other, making silly comments. They're not the sharpest tools in the shed. They get confused and lost and don't understand the tasks that they are assigned sometimes, and they are comic relief in the show. And it was surprising. That was one thing that I found so surprising about this article was these individuals who are just kind of bumbling idiots, just barely surviving some of these encounters, not really being productive or an asset to the main supervillain. Now, this article would suggest that they are actually romantically involved. This article, they interviewed Cam Clark, who is a voice actor for the original cartoon. He voiced both Leonardo and Rocksteady. And he was quoted saying, as for Rocksteady's relationship with Bebop, I think maybe they were lovers. Before comparing the ambiguous nature of their friendship to Bert and Ernie. The article goes on and says even though that they discussed previous girlfriends that was prior to their mutation, Bebop and Rocksteady are monstrously stronger and larger than regular humans. So particularly speaking, there wouldn't be many options besides each other. This is one thing that the world has done one is the practice of abstinence is unheard of and almost not socially acceptable anymore. When in fact, the practice of abstinence is 100% preventing unplanned births and significantly lowers your risk of getting an STD. So you think, it's interesting, you think that this idea of abstinence would be encouraged. And it's this author also can't wrap his mind around that this is a child's cartoon and the intimacy between the characters should never really have been brought up. There's no reason to do it. And then to go on to further suggest that because everybody has to be getting it on with someone somewhere, Bebop and Rocksteady really have limited options. What they do on the Technodrome, which is like their evil headquarters, there's a little bit more to that, but that's basically what it is. And it goes on to talk about that they're not getting with the two main, their leaders, and it even goes on to discuss orifices that one of the individuals have, and if they were going to be intimate with one another, that it wouldn't be very pleasant. There's also part of the bad guy army are robotic foot soldiers, and the author even states that they could be intimate with one of these, but they most likely would have to reprogram them, and since Bebop and Rocksteady aren't the sharpest tools in the shed, they probably would not be able to do it, so therefore we have ruled everybody out, and since the author of this article can't see that anyone would ever practice abstinence, that therefore the only two individuals left would be each other. They also interviewed a writer of the 2012 cartoon, and of course he's quoted saying, "It's great how the fans have interpreted their friendship. On one hand, some see it as two guys with a great friendship, and others really want it to be a gay relationship, which I am all for." Now, if that doesn't say hidden agenda to you, I don't know what will. So one thing that's been a lot in the news a lot recently is Layla Thomas and this whole idea of gender dysphoria. Previously, when it came to an individual's sexual orientation, whoever they were attracted to, I was more libertarian on the idea. Whatever they wanted to do, whatever anybody wanted to do in their own home, as long as it didn't hurt anybody or really affect anybody, they should be able to do whatever they wanted to do. But recently, I've begun to ask myself, when I see injustice in the world, when am I required to stand up and say something? And the second part is, where does it end? Currently, we let biological men compete in sports with biological female and also allow them to be housed in the same prison with biological females. Are we ever going to get to a point where if a minor wants to make radical changes that will affect them for the rest of their life, biologically, surgical wise, that can never be undone for the rest of their life, and a parent steps in and says, maybe this is not the right decision, are they going to take your child away from you? So unfortunately, the LGBTQ community and liberal Larrys and Lindas, you have forced my hand and awakened the beast within. I wanted to live and let live. But there has to be a point where a line is drawn in the sand. And once that line is crossed, I feel as if I have to stand up and say something. So I've kind of had this opinion for a while and this thought, especially with the way that crime is just getting out of control in this country. In New York City, individuals who try to push people in front of buses or subways or sneak up on women from behind and sucker punch them or hit them with baseball bats, shoot homeless people. If an African-American male shoots another African-American male and it's gang-related violence, usually the culprit or what it is blamed on is mental illness. Well, it's either blamed on the gun or then mental illness. And this is also associated with homeless people and drug addicts and just addicts of anything. You have a mental illness. And instead of sending these people to prison, we have to get them therapy. But one thing that I've never understood is why that does not apply to individuals with gender dysphoria. These individuals want to alter their body for life, and our society has normalized that and accepted that as reality. Now, when you begin this conversation, or you even try to stand up and say that there's a difference between men, individuals who are born men, and individuals who are born female, the topic of intersex is always brought up. And I'm really not sure why this is used as a defense. I guess it has something to do with you let these individuals pick their sex, or these individuals are not really have a gender at birth. So therefore, that anybody else who feels that way, it makes that okay. But when we look at this scientifically, the number of these individuals, of these intersex individuals, is it's very, very, very low. And there was a study done by Annie Fastrow Sterling that suggested the percentage of intersex individuals might be 1.7%. But they spread a very large net when doing this. And there's a PubMed article that actually defutes that number and says, if we stick with a consistent term of intersex, the definition that's accepted by scholarly and the popular media, it's restricted to those conditions in which chromosomal sex is inconsistent with phenotypic sex, or in which the phenotype is not classifiable as either male or female. Well, chromosomal sex is XY chromosomes, and phenotype is what you visually see. So if we stick with that definition, which is accepted by both scholarly and popular media, the true prevalence of intersex individuals is almost 100 times lower than what they calculated. It's closer to 0.018% of the population is intersex. To put that in perspective for you, if we take a fully filled Soldier Field, which is the stadium of the Chicago Bears and is the smallest stadium currently in the NFL, it seats 61,500 people. If the entire Soldier Field stadium is sold out, there would be a tiny bit more than 11 individuals in the stadium who were born intersex. Be 11.07. And hopefully we can all find common ground that these individuals did not choose this for their life. These individuals should have special accommodations made for them. And these individuals have probably had more surgeries, taken more medication, and had more therapy sessions than the other 61,489 individuals combined. So hopefully we can find common ground with all of those things. However, my argument is that these individuals were born this way. They didn't develop or were born with a mental illness. They were born with a physical deformity, what I might call a disability. Now, that number comes from, like I said, a PubMed article. There's another PubMed article that says, to a survey done in 2016, 0.3 to 0.5% of the population claims to have some sort of gender dysphoria or gender identification disorder. To put that in perspective for you, we take the same Soldier Field, 61,500. There would be about 307 individuals suffering from gender dysphoria. 307.5. And that comes from a PubMed study done in 2016 titled Hormone Therapy for Transgender Patients. Now, this is one thing about individuals who suffer from gender dysphoria that the left and PC culture and LGBTQ society wants to sweep under the rug is these healthy, mentally fit transgender individuals have a very high suicide rate. A study published in PubMed in April of 2020 indicated that 82% of transgender individuals have considered killing themselves and 40% have attempted suicide. Now, suicide is even higher in transgender youth. 56% of youth reported a previous suicide attempt and 86% reported to be currently suicidal. Now, there's another PubMed study, Suicide and Suicidal Behavior Among Transgender Persons, that was done in, or was published in November of 2016. This was a massive study. They took all the literature and content from three different sources: electronic databases, which included PubMed, ProQuest, Google Scholar, and PsycINFO. They did manual searches in hard copies of books in libraries and catalogs, and then gray literature, where they consulted with experts in this field. And they found a result. This study goes over multiple countries as well. The results of this study suggest that the suicide attempt rate is between 32 to 50% across all the countries done in this study. Now, this study talks a lot about different countries, but I really wanted to focus mainly on here in the United States. So 41% of transgender persons in the United States attempted suicide at least once in their life. That's 41%. In San Francisco, the prevalence of attempted suicide among transgender persons is 32. Younger than 25 years, it is 50%. 50% of transgenders in Australia have attempted suicide at least once in their lives. In England, 48% of transgender youth have attempted at least once in their lives. The prevalence of suicide remains high among transgenders, whether they've disclosed their gender status or are currently undergoing sex reassignment. So those two factors don't really play a part in the suicide rate. So according to this study, if we stick with that Soldier Field analogy, 307.5 would have gender dysphoria, and 41% of that, it would be 126 people. Now let's take a little bit more in-depth look at these 307 individuals in Soldier Field who identify as transgenders. And you tell me if it sounds like mental illness involved with this. 56% of them have discontinued their education at either primary level or secondary level. So they've dropped out of school. Over half. The majority of transgender persons, because they didn't finish their education, have either opted into the sex industry or are begging for survival. In Soldier Field, 307 transgenders, over half again, 54% of them have a habit of consuming alcohol. And only 14% of the transgender persons in Soldier Field consulted mental health professionals for their gender dysphoria, mostly because they were referred by the general physician, and rest of the respondents have sought help at traditional healers and transgender community leaders. 31% of transgenders are at high risk of tobacco use, and 15% abuse alcohol, and 26% of them claimed to suffer from severe depression. That is the brave and beautiful people that we are supposed to accept and normalize. And it's very interesting. If you read this entire PubMed study that I'm referencing, it's very, very woke. I mean, they have an agenda, but they can't dance around these numbers. There's no way to hide the science here. I'd never heard of this term, but this study continues to go on, and they conduct psychological autopsies for transgender individuals who had successful suicide attempts. And there are several factors that play into a part of why individuals committed suicide. And these numbers blew my mind. 64.3% of transgenders who successfully commit suicide recently had a breakup with a spouse or another romantic partner. 64.3%. That's almost two-thirds. Now, this is the number that the media forces on you, that wants to blame you for. Only 9.5% of individuals committed suicide, of transgender individuals committed suicide because of refusal of their gender sex reassignment by their family members. 9.5%. So if we look at Soldier Field again, 307.5 transgenders in the stadium, 126 have attempted suicide. One number that's left out is how successful they are. Let's just say it's half. So that would be 63 successful suicide attempts. If we take two-thirds of that 63 individuals in Soldier Field who have successfully committed suicide, who are transgender and have successfully committed suicide, that's almost 42 of those individuals. While refusal by their family is 9.5, let's just say about 10%, we're talking about 6 people who have committed suicide because of their family members. We'll go through the other factors real quick. One that I'm sure applies to the population as a whole. 9.5% committed suicide due to financial problems, and 2.4 committed suicide because they were recently diagnosed with HIV. Now, if that doesn't scream mental illness, I don't know what does. But I have more. We can keep going. We can go back to this PubMed study, hormone therapy for transgender patients. This is where we got the number of the reported amount of transgenders. This is something I've been very interested in for a long time. This study is very in-depth, lots of numbers. But one thing I want to point out right before we get into this, and I think it suggests some biases, is after they go through a lot of these numbers, they recommend that hormone replacement therapy, HRT, is begun before the age of 16. So this article starts off by comparing the difference between individuals transitioning to female and individuals transitioning to men. If you're transitioning to be a female, they pump you with estrogen, and it's loosely based on treatment used for postmenopausal women. Now, there's a whole nother study based off of postmenopausal women who take estrogen. The data shows that for every year you take estrogen, you show an increase of 2.3% risk of breast cancer. Menopausal women over the age of 50 who have used HRT, hormone replacement therapy, for 5 years, 2 in 1,000 develop breast cancer. For individuals, for women who have used it for 10 years, 6 in 1,000, and women who have used it for 15 years, it's 12 in 1,000. Then this study does something very interesting. It goes on to say that even though the data is not there, there is a moderate positive relationship between ovarian cancer and HRT, and a minor relationship between HRT and stroke. So if that's what this medicine does to a woman, I can only imagine what it does to a biological male. To go back to this study from 2016, hormone therapy for transgender patients, the data suggests that an individual live full-time as their self-affirmed gender for a predetermined period of time, and this study suggests 12 months before starting hormones, which makes complete sense to me. Why don't you give it a go before we make it permanent? However, this scientific study, I believe, shows some bias here and says, the recommendation was intended to help patients transition socially. However, both above-mentioned societies have recognized that this step is unreasonable for many patients, as social transition can be very challenging if there is incongruence between an individual's self-affirmed gender and their physical appearance. As a result, the updated guidelines do not require this step, and instead, the societies recommended that patients transition socially and with medical therapy at the same time. This study also suggests that men transitioning to female who take estrogen sometimes develop cardiovascular disease, and it suggests a trend towards an increased risk of heart disease. If a transgender individual also has diabetes and is taking estrogen, they are at a significantly higher risk for cardiovascular disease, and they have seen it play an important role in the rising risk of cardiovascular morbidity in trans women on estrogen. Now, when we start looking at females transitioning to males, this article, I'm not going to go fully into this, but this article talks a lot about testosterone and other drugs given to individuals transitioning to be men. One of the most interesting things is that the drugs vary country by country. So some testosterone is available in Europe, but is not approved by the FDA in the United States, and vice versa. This study shows that most female to male patients, unless testosterone is administered during the pre-pubertary period, there's some degree of feminization that has already taken place that cannot be reversed. It's interesting that the study says that for females transitioning to males, but it doesn't say it for males to transitioning to females. However, you would think it would apply equally. This study continues, as a result, many transgender men are shorter, have some degree of feminine fat distribution, and often have broader hips than biological males. You would think you could say the same about biological males transitioning to females. You could say the complete opposite. They are often taller, they have some characteristics of men, including fat distribution, and often have broader shoulders. Now, the study does not say that, but that's something that I have seen. And if you do some research in some more conservative media outlets, that's something they suggest as well. Testosterone also increases the risk of cardiovascular events. This study looked at 50 patients on testosterone for a time of 10 years and found that many patients had elevated cholesterol as well as developed high blood pressure. Now, when we get down to the special considerations of this study, they state that cross-sex hormones are usually recommended at the age of 16. However, in some situations when delay of therapy may lead to psychological and cognitive trauma in a child, it may be appropriate to commence therapy early. So even when we follow the science, we shouldn't be allowing third graders to make decisions about their gender. When you follow the science, it says age 16. Another thing that they found in this study is that these mentally fit, completely normal individuals seek hormone therapy from alternative sources. 49%. They did a study of 314 trans women in San Francisco, and 49% were found to be taking hormones not prescribed by a clinic. This study also references another study and a recently published cross-sectional analysis by MEFM. It found that 1 in 4 trans women self-prescribe cross-sex hormones, most commonly through the internet. So if you had 49%, it's almost half. So if you had 100 trans individuals in the room, half of them have attempted suicide, and half of them are most likely taking hormones not prescribed by their doctors. The final thing to consider in this study, and this study, it dances around It wants to say something, but it can't come out and say it. Patients sometimes feel that roadblocks are placed in front of them when hormones are not prescribed right away, especially if they're being asked to seek further psychiatric care before initiating hormones. Some patients do require additional mental health care, but the time should be taken to explain to the patient that the provider who intends to prescribe hormones to patients is not trying to gatekeep the patient away from this type of therapy, but rather he or she is ensuring that the patient has a positive outcome on the therapy. This again speaks to the importance of a multidisciplinary approach to the care of these patients. The argument that I will make to you is that when an individual claims to have gender dysphoria, the immediate reaction from a doctor should be to get this individual psychiatric help. All during this pandemic, I've been told to wear a mask, to get shots, to get boosters, to lower my risk of catching or spreading the disease, to lower the risk. None of those things are 100% foolproof. Well, we're starting to find out that none of those things are 100% foolproof. However, an individual who is suffering from gender dysphoria has a 50% chance of taking hormones not prescribed by a clinic, just buying them off the street or taking them, getting them through information through the internet, and has a 50% chance to commit suicide. But yet, their rationalization that they are the wrong gender is being normalized. And you are deemed a bigot if you think anything other than they are brave and beautiful and that the government should pay for their transgender, their gender reassignment surgery. I had a friend ask me, what would I do if my son, who is about to turn 4, came to me and said, Daddy, you know what? I feel like a girl. And this is what I said. I would tell him in his letter to Santa that he should ask for gender transition surgery. And then I would ask him if his room was clean. The kid is 4. And this is going to bring me to the new Florida bill and why it's important and why as parents, it should be 100% fully supported. I'm going to reference 2 articles, both from liberal media outlets, USA Today. The article is entitled DeSantis Signs into Law What Critics Call the Don't Say Gay Bill. And an ABC News article titled So-Called Don't Say Gay Bill Not Officially State Law. Now, one thing that I love that both of these articles do is they keep quoting critics call or the so-called Don't Say Gay Bill. If Fox News or any sort of conservative media outlet did that, they would be deemed liars. They quote very little. And tell very little information about what the actual bill describes. And then they go on to, I hate to say spread misinformation, because the information that they do actually quote are other people's opinions, beliefs, and what other woke organizations have said about the bill. The first thing that's important to understand about this bill, and both of these articles state it, is that this bill was voted on and passed by the Florida state legislation. Then it was sent to Ron DeSantis' desk, where he signed the bill into law. So I would encourage any Floridian who is upset about this law to rethink who they vote for when it comes to their state legislation. Because Ron DeSantis then just put this into law by executive order and worked through the whole state legislation process and got to his desk and he signed it. And I'm not going to argue with you that the bill doesn't say gay. Everybody already knows that, and that's not my huge argument here. The argument that I'm going to make is what is actually in the bill and how that is going to help parents. This ABC News article describes the bill as banning classroom instruction on sexual orientation or gender identity in kindergarten through third grade and states that any instruction on those topics cannot occur in a manner that is not age appropriate or developmentally appropriate for students in accordance with state standards. And this is according to the legislation HB 1557. A couple of paragraphs down, it also quotes the bill. As parents can also decline any mental, emotional, and physical health services available to their children at school. And schools will be required to notify parents of their child's use of school health services unless there is reason to believe that disclosure would subject the student to abuse, abandonment, or neglect. So there is an out. If you still want to force gender reassignment surgery on a child, there is still out. If the school believes that it's going to subject the student to abuse, abandonment, or neglect, then they can move forward with whatever they want to do. But as a parent who believes in Christ and is involved in their child's life, I want to be aware of any sort of health services that my child is taking advantage of at school. And secondly, all I'm asking is third grade. Give me till third grade to share this beautiful gift that God gave us to my child. And maybe they should offer some sort of after school program for parents who are not involved and don't want to discuss these topics with their children. But it's third grade. And lastly, I'd like to share share a story from my own life. When I was young, one of the first memories I have, my father and I were doing yard work. I don't exactly 100% remember exactly what we were doing. I want to say my father was chopping firewood. I was probably 3 or 4 out there trying to help. I was probably more of a nuisance than anything. But I remember asking my father, why would anybody want to be a boy? And I'm pretty sure we had just had a friend who gave birth to a child. And I was just contemplating, what is the point of being a male? And from my understanding of sex at the time is, if you're a male, you can't carry a baby and you can't procreate. Therefore, what is the point? And instead of my father saying, you know what, John? Maybe you're right. Maybe, you know, maybe you're a girl. He looked at me and said, as a man, we are a provider. We continue to work hard and provide for our families so that women can give birth. And I vaguely remember him saying something about how giving birth and carrying a baby is not easy and how difficult it is. And that if we continue to do stuff around the house, especially yard work and bring in money, then it's one less thing that a mom has to worry about. And she can just focus on the baby, growing the baby, giving birth to the baby, and then taking care of the baby. Meanwhile, we continue to work, do the best that we can to help out, and be the foundation that everybody needs. And maybe that's a little misogynistic. Maybe that offends you. And I'm sorry if it does. But that is what I needed to hear at that point in my life. I was so impressionable. I was 3 or 4, just trying to figure out what the entire world is doing around me. What is my purpose? Why am I here? What am I supposed to do? I was so impressionable at the time. What if my father would have said, I don't know, John, maybe you are a girl. If you want to be a girl, you should be a girl. At the age of 3 or 4, how big of an impact would that have had on my life? I might have gone down a very deep rabbit hole that included a 50-50 shot that I'd be taking hormone medication off of the street, a 50-50 shot that I would commit suicide or attempt to commit suicide. But the world and liberal Larrys and Lindas out there want to normalize this. Now, this is a stretch, but I'm going to make a prediction right now. The next thing that they want to normalize are pedophiles. And just hear me out. I read an article. It was a fact check that basically said they don't want to normalize pedophiles. That's fine. But the article continued to refer to them as MAPS, which is stood for a minor attracted person. So maybe I'm wrong, but this is the line in the sand that I've drawn. People who suffer from gender dysphoria, they need to get psychiatric help prior to making any life-changing decisions. And if they are a minor and can't buy alcohol, cigarettes, don't choose their bedtime, and still believe in Santa Claus, then a parent or guardian needs to be involved. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. What if when I asked my father some of those questions, he had an agenda? Now, I'm sure a lot of you are going, well, he did. He's a misogynist. No, my father was speaking from experience. He was trying to answer the question of a 3, 4, maybe 5-year-old in the best way that he knew how. I was also his son. What if I had asked someone who had an agenda, who was not a relative, didn't even have children, someone with an agenda? I think my life might have been completely different. And as parents, when our children ask those questions, we have to be ready. As Christian parents, we have to be ready. And that is all the time that we have for today. Thank you so much for tuning in. Remember to rate, like, comment, and subscribe. Please look me up on social media. All the articles and research papers that I have referenced today are going to be on Facebook, Tumblr, and Minds. So if you're worried about one of your friends seeing you interacting with a chubby Caucasian Christian closeted conservative on Facebook, please join Tumblr and Minds. You don't even have to use your real name. They're more like blogs. But all of these articles, the majority of them have already been posted, and I got 1 or 2 that are going to come down the line this week after this episode is published. So please, search the Chubby Caucasian Christian Closeted Conservative and look for my eagle. I had a family member paint that eagle freehand, and I loved it so much that she gave me the original. She's very talented, very patriotic. She has a Redbubble account, so I encourage you, just go over to Redbubble, search Robin N. Brown. It's Robin the bird and the letter color brown. There's also a link to her Redbubble account in my description. So please, just head on over there, just give it a look, and we will see you later.